Hi and welcome to my favourite Elliott Smith song. If you haven't heard us before, this podcast is quite simple really. We try to do our bit to keep Elliott Smith's legacy alive by speaking to well-known fans about their favourite song of his. So hi and thank you for joining us for this episode. Today our guest is the musician Phil Elverum. Phil has been releasing music for more than 20 years now. First through his band The Microphones and then under the name Mount Eerie, a project he started in 2003 and is still running today. Over the course of his career, Phil has put out an amazing total of more than 40 albums. He's also a big Elliott Smith fan and discovered his music in the mid-90s and even saw Elliott play live a couple of times. He's got lots of interesting perspectives to share on his song pick and a lot more besides, so hopefully you do enjoy this interview. I'll hand you over now. Here is Phil Elverum talking to Elizabeth Withstanley.
I'm Phil Elverum from Mount Eerie. It was hard to pick a favorite, but I didn't understand.
Thought you'd be looking for the next in line to love, then ignore, put out, put away.
It was a favorite back in the day. Like when it came out, I loved that one. I tried to record songs like it. I failed. But it's so beautiful. It's just his voice. It's a cappella, choral. What year did that come out? It's the last song on EXO. And I remember I was a teenager, or maybe like 19, 20, and I was working on my first or second album, and I tried to record a song like that. I was also really into the Beach Boys then, and these like thick and interesting chords built out of multi-tracked voices. Also, another thing I really like about it is how it's so beautiful and kind of sacred sounding. But the lyrics are so direct and raw and just like, yeah, like basic language.
There's two opposite things happening with what you're hearing in the music. It seems like it's a different type of song, and then the lyrics are not that.
Yeah. Or they somehow, it makes it deeper or more beautiful. What's it like, the sacred and the profane? Like having the high and the low intermingled. My feelings never change a bit. I always feel like shit. I don't know why. I guess that I just do. Like it's almost like not poetic. It's not a song lyric, but he sings it so beautifully, and the chord is built up. But that sentence is just like, I don't know why. I guess that I just do. Like it's so clunky, the language of it, and I love how transcendent he makes that.
So you'd soon be leaving me alone, like I'm supposed to be tonight, tomorrow, and every day.
It's so beautiful and unique. And the chords, whatever the chords are, let alone the fact that he's singing them, just like building the chords up with his own beautiful voice that it's like probably not auto-tuned, but it seems so perfect. There's no sour notes in there. That's hard to do for me. And some people are good singers, I guess. But it's so sad. That song is so sad and so relatable. He's talking about the potential of connecting with another person and seeing it in retrospect. I could have gone to that place, but I didn't understand, he says. And it's like a really basic sadness that is so kind of quietly devastating. And also the line, a cloud of smoke trying to occupy space. What a fucking joke. That's so good and profound. I think that line stuck with me a lot.
There's nothing here that you'll miss. I can guarantee you this is a cloud of smoke. Trying to occupy space. What a fucking joke. What a fucking joke.
Yeah, I love this song. I'm looking at the lyrics now. I waited for a bus to separate the both of us. It's so pedestrian and, you know, like basic and grounded, the language. And it's like he's talking to a person. You painted pictures of a never, never land. It's like, yeah, he's like removed a lot of the poetry and metaphor, which is something I like to do sometimes. I think that to remove decoration from your language and have it still feel like transcendent and powerful and deep is such an amazing move. And I think this song is a really good example of that.
But then sort of how he, you know, the way he sings it and put it together, it's got that contradictory sort of feel. Because if you're not actually listening to the lyrics and you're just kind of hearing the song, like you're thinking, oh, this is like something so lovely, right?
Yeah, it sounds like a boys' choir or something. It sounds so beautiful. And it's got these parts that are, I guess it ends with, after the lyrics end, there's still some singing. And it's almost like, yeah, like Gregorian chanting or something. It's so beautiful and churchy almost.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's feels sacred. And then his lyrics are so not churchy. So just like, waiting for the bus. What a fucking joke. I didn't understand. I always feel like shit. It's just like a teenage journal writing. Not, I don't mean that in a derisive way either. I mean that in like, it's so beautiful in that way.
Yeah.
It's just so true.
That direct expression.
Exactly.
I waited for a bus to separate the both of us and take me all far away from you. 'Cause my feelings never change a bit. I always feel like shit. I don't know why, I guess that I just do.
I first encountered Elliot Smith on his self-titled album. I had a friend who went to Reed College in Portland and knew him like as a Portland guy, just like a friend of a friend. Oh, have you heard this CD? And she gave me like a dub tape of the self-titled album. And that's how I knew him. And then, yeah, it was amazing. This quiet acoustic guitar, deep songs, spooky voice. And then it was right around when Either Or was coming out, or he was playing those songs in 1997. I saw him play in Olympia at Yo-Yo Agogo, little music festival there at the Capitol Theater. And I was like right in front of him. I think he was maybe kind of getting pretty popular really quickly. I don't know. I don't have a good sense of that, of like his career arc, but it was a small show and I was sitting right in front of him, or standing right in front of him. And I remember just staring at his fingers as he played. And I had never seen guitar playing like that before, where it was so complex, like the chords he was playing and playing the bass notes, like bass lines, and also these high flourishing chord things. And that's the part that blew me away. And I remember thinking like, who's this guy, this Portland guy? I was still like a teenager in my town, Anacortes, Washington, setting up shows at the record store, trying to get people that seemed like friends to come and play for no money. And I asked my friend Lois, who knew him. I think they had worked together. Lois, do you think I could get Elliot to come and play at the business at the record store? And she just laughed because I think he was already kind of blown up right then.
I mean, it is kind of an unusual song. It does sort of stand out on the album, I think.
Yeah, that's another part of what I like about it, is that it's the last song on the album. And the album is amazing, and the production is all over the place and so complex and like ornate. And then this last song is this, is coda the word? It's like this. In his catalog, I don't know if there are other songs that are just choral a cappella like this. Probably not. I don't know all the rarities and stuff, but this one is pretty unusual.
And so as someone kind of starting out early in your career, you were thinking, wow, I wish I could do something in this realm?
Kind of, yeah. I tried to record a song where the main meat of the music was my voice making chords, but I'm not a great singer. Like, I'm not an accurate singer like he was. So when I listened back to that song, I think it's called It Wouldn't. It's on my first CD, Don't Wake Me Up. The chords, like my voice is just wavering all over the place and it's pretty sour sounding to me. But that was my attempt at sort of following the inspiration of this song. And it's not the first time. There were other songs earlier on, like earlier tapes of mine, where I definitely was going for some of the simple pop production that's on either or. Like the 8-track recording or 4-track recording, but so like punchy and I don't know, like Beatles-y. So pared down, but so powerful.
You once talked to me about love, and you painted pictures of a never, never land.
There are some parts on Figure Eight, though, that also really hit me hard. Like, I almost picked for my song for this, the pair of songs, Everything Reminds Me of Her and Everything Means Nothing to Me, because I really love what they do on the album, like sequenced how they are. I love how they go into each other and how they're sort of like these twins. I think they're super interesting. I don't know if they're meant to be related to each other, but they, I love that. And that influenced me a lot when I was recording, but back in those days, like making albums that sort of had songs that were interwoven with each other.
Right. Yeah, it's a very interesting concept to kind of let an idea move that way. And I mean, I think the whole idea of the progression of the album is interesting too. I don't know, maybe people these days just listen to like a song here and there, but it's nice when you can listen to the whole album and absorb kind of the whole thought and sort of see where it goes, which I feel is something that you're very interested in too.
Yeah. And I don't know if there's like one thing that's better or worse, but that's just the era I was born into, or like, that's the way that I came to understand music, was through this format of like 30 to 40 minute long collection of songs that work as a cohesive whole. But yeah, it's true. We don't live in an era like that anymore. We live in shorter attention span time. Roman Candle, I want to talk about for a sec because it's so weird. is that his first one?
Yes.
And it's like, seems like a lot of instrumentals, a lot of no names. It has such a distinct flavor. There have been long stretches of time where that's been my favorite one, but not because it has like hits or like incredible production or anything, but just because it's such a distinct tone and flavor that none of his other albums have, or nobody's albums have. It's like something about the way it was recorded. There's like a weird kind of blanket over everything. Sometimes that's the perfect tone that I'm in the mood for. One of the other ones I almost picked was St. Ide's Heaven, because the harmonies on the chorus, I think it's Rebecca Gates singing with them. I just always have it stuck in my head. It's like so beautiful. And the way it comes like almost towards the end of the album, and it's like this new voice all of a sudden after an album that's been pretty much only one person playing guitar and singing. Then there's this other person and there's like these beautiful harmonies. It's that stands out too in terms of like making a tonal shift in an album. I loved it. And also it's just really fun to sing along with. I think I end up singing the Rebecca Gates part during these times. Like, that came out in 95, my computer says. And so, yeah, I was a teenager working at a record store in a small town, but like really into Pacific Northwest alternative music. So I was a fan of the Spinanes and of Lois. I think either Lois sings on one of his songs or he sings on one of Lois's songs. But yeah, like recognizing these names. Oh, maybe like Mary Lou Lord had some collaboration. So yeah, putting the social scene together of these seem like, oh, these friends are singing on each other's records, and it's so beautiful and cool, and recognizing people's voices and scrutinizing the liner notes. That was a big deal for me. Elliot Smith is however many years older than me, 8, 10. And it seemed like the upperclassmen, and like being in high school and looking up to the seniors and being impressed by what they're doing and like wanting to emulate it.
And I could have gone to that place, but I didn't understand. I didn't understand. I didn't understand.
For some reason, Elliot Smith's music is often sort of thrown in that camp of sad music, which I think is kind of a frequent interpretation of yours as well. Elliot Smith's music to me is like not sad whatsoever. So I always struggle with like people, and you know, I just can't relate to how that context comes through for people. I'm just curious, does that context come through in his music to you?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's true. My music has that reputation, and it's a little bit frustrating also. I always kind of chalk it up to the prevailing appetite for negativity or darkness or sadness being kind of low and flimsy and not really like available for much nuance. So Elliot Smith singing about some kind of like interesting and beautiful darkness or struggles or whatever, like, you know, they're closing down the bar and the bartender's singing Clementine. Like, it's sad and also beautiful and poetic, but that amount of sadness seems like it overwhelms a lot of people. And there's like, this is the saddest thing I've ever heard in my life, and this music makes me want to kill myself. Like, people have so.
It's that expression of emotion. Like, I think, you know, even just looking at your three or four last albums, you know, you're expressing such emotion and trying to kind of work through things, which I think is similar in the sense to many of his songs. He's expressing thoughts that are fairly emotional and you know, relatable too.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of it is, it's not like happy-go-lucky falling in love stuff. He's talking about the full spectrum. And it is true, to be fair, like I've made some pretty overtly sad and heavy like subject matter albums, and so has Elliot Smith. So it's not like it's not baseless to think of it that way, but it is frustrating how the perception of sadness can sort of overwhelm everything else and all the other nuance that's going on in there. Because, yeah, like real sadness is not musical. Real sadness doesn't produce beautiful music. It's like actual sadness is just like a swamp of depression that makes no art comes from it. So, yeah, I've like devoted my whole artistic life, I think, to exploring the full spectrum and those nuances. And it seemed like Elliot Smith was sort of doing a whole thing, telling stories about like the roller coaster of emotions that goes all over the place.
It seems like that's something that's maybe drawn you to his music.
Yeah, I suppose so. I wonder. I don't feel like it was ever exactly like the lyrics or the stories he was telling that was the thing that was grabbing me. I mean, I like that stuff, but that wasn't what drew me to it. I think it was his amazing songwriting and musicianship and production. The way he put songs together was genius. I remember reading early on, I think it was around Either Or, an interview with him in Tape Op magazine, which is like, it probably still exists, but back then it was like a zine about home recording and four tracking. And they were interviewing this like other Portland guy named Elliot Smith. And he was talking about recording on a four track, and I hadn't heard his music actually. I was just reading about some guy recording on a four track, and it just stuck with me, like the ideas he had about recording. And so, and that was totally my fixation too during those times. I didn't care so much about songwriting or like storytelling. I was really into music, like recording, about like atmosphere making and how songs were built and what a snare drum could sound like. And yeah, just the whole everything of sound.
Which I guess is kind of how you started with your first band name is the Microphones.
Yes, exactly. That's why I called it that. I was just obsessed with recording. And then later sort of came to being more interested in actually like writing songs and saying things. But at first it was very much about song building, about, yeah, I don't know how else to put it. There's a distinction between like recording and songwriting. Elliot Smith was super good at both of those things.
That gets to the end of my questions. I don't know if you had any other things about Elliot Smith that we didn't touch upon that you wanted to
know. No, I mean, this is unrelated, but I just popped into my head that since I heard it, however many years ago, over 20 years ago, the line, if you're alone, it must be you who wants to be apart, that's been stuck in my head, like as a like guiding principle about like sadness and isolation. And so I don't know how that fits into anything else we've talked about, but I love that line. Alone, it must be you who wants to be apart. Nobody broke your heart.
You are drawn to the lyrics because you.
Oh, for sure. No, I've come to them. I'm just, when I was saying that before, it wasn't the first thing that drew me to them. But yeah, I think he's a great writer and has a really interesting, like, X-ray vision on human sadness, suffering, and happiness, joy, and yeah. The whole thing.
So thanks very much to Phil for taking part in the show. It was a real pleasure to have him as a guest. And that's pretty much it from me today. Just the usual reminder that we're on social media if you want to stay up to date with everything that we've got going on with the podcast. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We'll be back with a new episode in a couple of weeks' time when our guest will be the musician Matthew Cause from the band Nada Surf. Thanks again to Phil Elverum for being our guest today. Thank you to Elizabeth Wood-Stanley for producing the show with me. And thank you for listening to it. We'll see you in a couple of weeks' time.